thank y'all for coming here. I would like to shift gears in one sense, but also continue the conversation in another sense. We're going to move a lot farther back in time on the scale of millions and even billions of years, and I'm going to talk about chemistry. But Dennis and I actually have a bit in common. We're both affiliated with the BioLogos Voices program, and also we have two other speakers at this conference. April and Richard will be speaking tomorrow. And I believe there is a table set up if you want to know more about that. Here's a screenshot that shows both of us on the same page to prove it. Okay. But I'm under physical sciences. He's under biological. But what I'd like to talk about, I'd like to talk about the chemistry and biology coming together. And one of the settings in which it comes together is a hike that's actually not quite around the corner, but maybe in Canadian terms around the corner from here. It's about 8 hours away. And we're talking about in Kootenai National Park. I was told that's how you pronounce it. And if you drive up there, you can take a hike and you can find some fossils. And so I have four boys and I wanted to do a family trip. We were up in Banff and I wanted to find some fossils. Turns out this is the only hike that you can do where you can find the fossils without being guided. Okay, so this is a little travel tip right here. Now, of course, because I was the one suggesting this, I had to take the responsibility for what went wrong if things went wrong, if the kids couldn't make it or if they started crying, you know, and things like that. So I can tell you about my perspective as a father taking my boys on this trip. But really, we are going to observe biology embedded in chemistry. That's what fossils are. So the thing I knew about the hike is it started off with a large elevation climb. And this was the part I was worried about. And you can see that right here, I took a picture of us going up on top of the elevation climb. We had a really great view because there had been a forest fire that was still recovering from. And so you had the hot sun beating down. You're constantly going up. My kids were whining. They were straggling. You can see that the picture is we had to make sure that the last one, my wife was walking in the back to make sure he didn't like decide to turn around and run down the trail. And they're like, why are we doing this? Okay. And I was trusting that we'd be able to find some fossils, so I was encouraging them by faith, not by sight. Then we got up to the top, and it flattened out, and we got into the Hanging Valley. This was scraped out by a glacier long ago. And you can see, you can even imagine how it was scraped out. And you can see now I'm actually taking a picture from behind my youngest child, who is actually running ahead of me. The other thing I can't show you, but I can tell you, is it was like stepping up into an open refrigerator door or air conditioning coming on, because the geology of this causes this to be much cooler, and this is very refreshing. And then I thought we might actually be able to do this. So I followed the instructions, and it said to turn right before you reach the glacier and go to the waterfall. I saw the glacier down there. I see the waterfall up here. I know we're on the right track. And so I tell my boys, okay, that's the time to go toward the waterfall. The waterfall brought fossils down and it scattered them all over the floor of this valley. And so then we started turning over rocks. And this is what we found. It's a little bit small. You know, the picture isn't the greatest, but if you look carefully right here, we found that's not chemical, you know, that's not solely chemical. It's biological and it's a fossil and it's also weird, you know, it's like nothing else we've ever done. I actually have an illustrator who worked with me on doing these kind of fossil pictures. And I think this is very provisional. I think it's this one, this Wawaxia. So another kid found this one. All your kids can find a fossil. That was the other thing I was worried about, fossil jealousy, if one of them found one and no one else did. Another one found this one, and this one is, again, clearly biological, and I identify it very amateurly as this one that I can't even pronounce. The reason why there are so many fossils in this is these are all of one age, and there's this time called the Cambrian explosion that they noticed long ago, paleontologists noticed, all of a sudden you get all of these weird complex fossils. And so I can tell you, I've been there, I've turned over rocks, and I've seen that. So the question is, why did we do this? You know, I was asking that to myself when we were going up the hard part of the first part of the trail. But then it takes on a different tone after it was successful. You can see that they're very happy now that they found fossils and things like that. By the way, you can't keep the fossils. You need to leave them up there, but you can take pictures. Okay. But why did we do this? The proximate cause is that I wrote a book about it and I worked with an illustrator to illustrate these things. And I wanted to find out if they really were as easy to find as people said they were. And so I had written chapter 9 of a book about how chemistry shaped biology. And chapter 9 is about the Cambrian explosion. And you'll notice the chapter title includes oxygen on it. So that was the reason why I found it in the first place. But then why did I drag my kids along? You know, they haven't read the book. It's not for them. Hopefully they will someday, you know. But the ultimate cause of why I dragged my kids along that only became clear upon reflection later. And it's sort of a theological reason. I think that I did it because we were shaping their imaginations. Why do you go on a hike? You know, it comes from a conviction that the natural world was created. It was spoken into being by God. And because of that, when you immerse yourself in it, you're hearing his voice in some maybe dim, maybe hard to understand, maybe only on reflection do you really hear it more clearly. But if you think about it, this is the kind of metaphor and image that Jesus used all the time in his parables. And it forms, if you form your imagination with nature, if you form it with things like seeds sown and growing into plants, lilies, sparrows flying or falling, that's a bridge to the whole universe and to the words of Jesus in the Gospels. In fact, it's also the same world that provides the sacraments. And so there's real theological depth to doing that. This is an old idea. It actually goes a long way back, but even as far back as Samuel Taylor Coleridge, a poet who actually had a lot of friends who were scientists, he would hope that his children would walk through nature and hear God's voice in this way. This is an excerpt from one of his famous poems, Frost at Midnight. He's speaking to his young son, possibly in a cradle exactly like this, in front of this fireplace, and he's saying what he hopes for his son. He hopes that that thou shalt wander like a breeze by lakes and sandy shores. And if you skip down a little bit, so shalt thou see and hear the lovely shapes and sounds intelligible of that eternal language which thy God utters. A tie to the language metaphor from Dennis's talk and even to the Language of God book that was mentioned earlier today. Who from eternity doth teach himself in all and all things in himself, great universal teacher, he shall mold thy spirit and in giving make it ask. This is articulated much more clearly than I had, but it's the same motivation. So I want to look at those fossils and think about them in the context as a chemist who wrote a book about how chemistry influenced those fossils. I want to ask the question, because God made those fossils and God made our minds, we can ask what those fossils mean. This is actually something that Coleridge also said. One of the things of the Cambrian explosion is creativity was more than I expected. We found fossils everywhere. Also, the age is more than I originally expected. When I was growing up, I expected things to be relatively young from my reading of the Bible in Genesis, a thousands of years scale maybe. This is definitely millions of years scale, and that's backed up by my chemical experience as well. So what do we do with these two things? Well, when I look at the Cambrian explosion now, I see it through the eyes of a chemist, and I see a chemical reason why it might have happened. If it's chemical in nature, it comes from the periodic table, it's therefore universal and predictable, at least for water-based planets like ours. Because of this, the world has a deep intelligibility to it. It does have a language that we can listen to. And evolution contains a deep structure in addition to its deep freedom. I think Dennis talked a lot about its freedom. And I'm going to talk about the flip side of it, the structure of it. So I want to use a different metaphor. I like to use, of course, we think about things as natural laws, and the natural laws are the reasons why things happen. I want to reach back to actually an old metaphor that was suggested by the Stoics originally, picked up by St. Augustine, called the seeds of reason. That's a translation of rationes seminales. And Alistair McGrath pointed this out in his Gifford lecture, that Augustine argued that certain principles of order were embedded within the creation, which developed as appropriate at later stages. This is not exclusive to natural laws. It's in addition to natural laws. Augustine himself says, God created what was to be in times to come from the earth, in the earth from the beginning, in what I might call the roots of time. That fits very well with the image that we see of creation now. The seed metaphor was actually a competing metaphor early on, but Descartes and Newton and others decided that laws were a better metaphor for describing nature, and we've sort of lost the idea. I want to bring it back and apply it to a specific chemical instance of oxygen. I want to suggest that oxygen can be considered a seed that eventually grew and developed and possibly even helped cause the Cambrian explosion that we saw. So one of the things about considering the elements as seeds is that the sowing metaphor comes very naturally. The Big Bang only produced hydrogen and helium, and so only produced the very top of the periodic table that you see here. The rest of the table came about by fusion in the middle of stars, brought about by gravity. The elements combined to make things like 3, 4, 5, 6 protons, which is carbon, 8 protons, which is oxygen. But of course, it's still stuck in the middle of a star. The thing about stars is as they age, they eventually run out of fuel, collapse, and explode. And this sows the seeds across the universe. So why am I focusing on oxygen? Well, it's not just because, it's not for arbitrary reasons, but it's because it's in a unique place on the periodic table. Therefore, it's universal. And it also has unique characteristics. Oxygen is good for building. Once you get through organic chemistry, you can see how oxygen forms two tight bonds or one double bond. So it's good for making structures, linked structures. It's good for burning. Have you ever noticed why fire is always hot? I mean, it seems kind of self-obvious, but why can you burn anything, combine it with oxygen, and have heat come out? Why? If you think about it, that's kind of weird. And it's weird because of oxygen's properties. It's because oxygen has an unusually weak double bond, and it will combine with anything to give off heat. There's a paper about this on the handout that says a lot more for those interested. The biggest thing about oxygen, though, is because of these two characteristics, it actually will transform the environment that it's released into. Oxidation is a very common chemical process. Oxygen takes away electrons from other elements, and it's in a set order depending on the physical configuration of the electrons in those elements. It's related to the redox potential, if you've heard that in chemistry class. And the important thing about it is related to the periodic table. And so you can say, what order will things be oxidized in? And it will be true for anything that has the similar environment. Also, oxygen has some other cool tricks, like it will protect the Earth from radiation. The green glow you see here is a picture taken from the space station of oxygen doing this protection from cosmic rays. But let's talk about oxygen's characteristics in the history of life. The one thing that I have, and I actually have it right here. I brought along the museum because I can't take you all on a hike with me unless you're up for that later. I brought the museum to you. This is a lucite block that has these pictures, and this is microscopic pictures that I took of the lucite block. And what this has is it has a little chunk of the oldest Earth. And so you'll have to trust me because you're kind of far away, but I took this picture from this lucite block. I have a piece of the oldest Earth. And by the way, at breaks or things like that, I'll have this with me and I can show you the mini museum. There's the oldest Earth right there. And the thing about oldest Earth is that this little chunk of Earth is full of oxygen because oxygen originally that was made in stars bound to metals and then ended up being solid rather than in the air. So life could not breathe it. Life could not use it as effectively. It was all locked up. This zirconium has 4 oxygens for every 2 non-metal or every 2 other atoms. It's very hard and it has a high melting point. That's why it survives so long. And that's why we can date it to be more than 4 billion years old. So the seed of oxygen was locked up. But again, if you think about the parable of the sower, wasting seed has precedence in the stories of creation that Jesus told. Just because seed is wasted does not mean it's a way that God didn't create. You know, God creates through these processes. And so the thing about oxygen, the oxygen was locked away, and then how did it get out of the Earth? There's several possible ways that it could have gotten into the air and the gas ultimately. But one of the ways is that life could have reorganized the planet itself. Life will get energy from combining things and bringing things down in energy. And to do that, it needs to have a constant internal chemical environment. So every living cell requires a specific chemical balance. And the thing I want you to notice about this balance, down here, the balance is that oxygen is ejected from the inside of life. Calcium also is ejected from the inside of life. Because of this, there's a mini museum that has a chunk of the earliest life, which is a calcium oxygen rich stuff that was ejected and rocks that were made by earliest life in these cool layers. They're called stromatolites. And basically that's life going through and reorganizing the environment and ejecting the oxygen. So as the oxygen was ejected, the environment oxidized and the oxygen started to react. We have evidence that this happened on a planetary scale. So we have a chart here. Here's a piece of oxygen-rich iron rock that appeared worldwide. So it's oxygen and iron bound together. And if you look right here on the chart shows two things. It shows oxygen going up on the black line, and it shows the geological appearance of these banded iron formations, which appear to be caused by oxygen. The interesting thing about that is, first of all, the first banded iron formation happens right after photosynthesis occurs. And then oxygen starts to go up, banded iron formations start to appear. And it looks like oxygen starts to jump up in two steps. One step 2.5 billion years ago, and one step 0.7 billion years ago. This is very curious timing, especially for the second step. And these are found worldwide. The interesting thing, and there's a paper with this on your handout, both of the great oxygenation events, they follow the same path. There are seven events in order, and they remark in the paper about how curious it is that the same events happen in the same order. This is not a disordered behavior of a system. This is an ordered steps that the system goes through in order to put the oxygen into the air and get it into the atmosphere. So once the oxygen is in the atmosphere, it can be used for building. There's references about how it built sterols. In particular, it built cholesterol for the first time. Bigger, more flexible cells resulted. And it also built nitrate. Nitrate is actually a fuel for microbes. So the oxygen allowed building and it allowed complexity. And after the second oxidation event, even more building energy and complexity were allowed. And so that's why I want to propose, because the second oxidation event happens before the Cambrian explosion, and because we have these chemical connections to complexity and energy of life, I want to suggest that this oxygen is the seed that fell on good ground. It yielded a crop, and it yielded a crop of fossils that my kids could go find. This is in another, this Japanese star sand is an example of the fossils that you find there. So one of the effects of this, of the great oxidation events, not just banded iron formations, but also glacial activity, like what we saw evidence of when we went on our hike. So before the Cambrian, you had the most extreme ice ages that ever happened in the Earth. And in this case, this is a chemical event in which the glaciers are going to scrape the earth down and they're going to mix phosphorus, calcium, iron, other things into the ocean. And so you see right here, this is the gray line is oxygen, and it goes up before the black line, which is biological families. The really interesting thing about it is that there's a general correlation between the two in complexity that continues. It goes up when biological complexity goes up, and even more dramatically, it goes down when biological complexity goes down. It looks like loss of oxygen may be connected to extinctions. So that's the, in conclusion, this gives a picture in which oxygen is a seed. It allowed for, even caused a world. And the complexity that I'm talking about is necessary, but not sufficient for creatures to relate to their creator. It allows the hominids populations to form. Oxygen provides the energy and structures for this, and there's a lot of arguments, what energy, what structures, that's in my book. The seed of oxygen ultimately bore fruit, and I want to think about it that way, not as a natural law, but as a seed of reason. And the mind matches the world because God made them both. I want to close with another parable that Jesus spoke about a seed, which is in Mark 4, right after the parable of the sower, that is more familiar. The kingdom of God is as if a man should scatter seed on the ground, should sleep by night and rise by day. The seed should sprout and grow. He himself does not know how. But the earth yields crops by itself. First the blade, then the head. After that, the full grain in the head. First the first oxygenation event, then the second. But when the grain ripens, immediately he puts in the sickle because the harvest has come. This says to me that creation by seeds, it depends on God. It requires patience. And it creates a world in which we can participate and name and create language about and talk to each other about, ultimately talk to God. Thank you.
Okay, are there questions for Ben? First of all, we need to make a PDF file available for those who did not get copies of your handout.
Okay? Yeah, the PDF of the slides already has the handout
okay.
at the end of it.
Great.
So I want to make sure I just understand this metaphor of seeds. So, a seed obviously has, in a way, the structure of the plant within it, but oxygen is more of an enabler, right? So you might say that cruise ships only emerge when there are oceans.
Right.
And you notice if oceans are declining, then so are cruise ships and so on. But it doesn't mean that oceans kind of create cruise ships. Is it something like that? Then it's not really like seeds in that sense.
Yeah, I think you see that historically people used to envision seeds as having like a little copy of the plant or the human inside it, But as we've gone along, we've seen that the seeds don't have an exact copy. They have they develop according to sort of a program. And when you have life, you have the genes that can provide that program. What I'm suggesting here is that there are certain characteristics, chemical characteristics, that provide the energy and structures that provide a sort of program. It's a looser program. And it's not like you can, if you zoom in on an oxygen, you're not going to see a little Cambrian explosion or things like that. It's definitely more metaphorical, but it's also how the oxygen relates to the environment. And I think that the way the oxygen has its chemistry in it leads life down a certain path. The biggest thing about this is because the periodic table is universal, then this path is also universal. And it suggests that there's some sort of convergence. At least, again, I've always got to include this, at least for water-based chemistries. There might be other chemistries out there that I can't speak to. But for water-based chemistries, it looks like you have this order, this chemical order in which you have old things and you have new things, and oxygen becomes available only after a struggle to get it out of the place where it's locked away. I would suggest that this pattern would occur, and this is the thing that's really, it's not necessarily inside the oxygen, but it's in the relationship of oxygen to its environment. So.
Thank you for your talk. Could you help unfold something for me? I was tracking with the notion of seeds, metaphor, so on and so forth. And then this claim, mind matches the world because God made them both. I couldn't quite track your logic, how you get from what you're talking about to the notion of mind and so forth. Can you just explicate for me where that comes from? Because I missed it.
Well, actually, that's from Coleridge. And I have a couple of extra slides because I knew I wouldn't be able to fully explain. This is not about where mind comes from. I would say that this that's a necessary but not sufficient piece of this. And I think that actually, if you ask me, I think mind comes from some sort of event that's described in Genesis 2 as God breathed into Adam's nostrils and made a living being. I don't want to define that chemically, okay? But I want to define the creation of Adam's body chemically. I'm comfortable doing that. I think mind, and one of the things that Coleridge provides, is he starts off by saying, the mind is not some passive thing stuck in a mechanism. He starts off from mind and comes to matter from that direction. And I'm just starting to think about this because I'm just getting into Coleridge. But he starts from a different direction, but I think he has useful things to say about how the mind is a little I am that is an echo of the great I am that is God the Creator. And that's what it means to have. You can trust your mind's conclusions when you look at the world. And you come to conclusions about it, like the banded iron formations, the age of these different things. I think that because of creation is why I trust those isotope datings. And it's why I can trust that the picture in my mind can match the picture of the way that God created it. It's an intelligible universe. And I don't think you get that if you don't start with the great I am. If mine's just developed, you can't trust it.
Yeah. Last question.
Thank you. So I understand that there's a relationship between multicellularity and oxygen, and even say the size of insects and oxygen or other various organisms. But it seemed like you were suggesting perhaps there's a once multicellularity is established, there's a relationship between oxygen and biodiversity. So if that's causal, could you expand on exactly what that relationship would be?
Well, one of the things is that on that chart, it gets more complex. And that's a sort of the basic thing right here. But you see the carboniferous part of this, where oxygen went up and biodiversity did not. There appears to be a limit, for one thing, for what oxygen can provide, because once it's provided the structures and the energy, you don't get, maybe it's diminishing returns. So I'm not sure about the middle of the graph. But I do think that there's something really interesting going on there, not necessarily in the rise, but in the sudden drop that goes along with that, one of those, that's possibly, I believe that's the biggest extinction that we've experienced. And the question there is oxygen a cause or an effect? You see that you can't tell on this graph because we can't tell yet with our dating. In fact, even the dating of oxygen predating the Cambrian explosion is, it's a little bit contested, but it seems like the field is mostly in the realm of saying that oxygen really is a cause. And I sort of included hedging language in all of that. But I really think as a chemist, I think I see the reasons why that could have happened, because I think I can see the structures, I can see the energy. Once those structures are developed and oxygen is introduced, I don't think you get much more by going to 30% from 20%. I think a logarithmic scale for oxygen is what's important. But that might begin to answer the question.
Okay, let's thank our speaker.